Hello, and welcome to Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde, a reporter for NPR affiliate KUOW here in Seattle. She's Erica C. Barnett, editor and publisher of Publicola. And Erica has like 30,000 followers on Twitter. Hi, Erica.
Hi. Does that mean I finally matter?
You know, it means you are 30,000 followers on Twitter. Sandeep Kaushik has about 1,400 Twitter followers. I'm thinking like 1,400 Twitter followers. Folks out there could help you out.
Yes, yes. Follow me on Twitter because that's what will make me a virtuous person. Like Erica.
That's how I do it.
My virtue is measured by my Twitter following.
All right, today we're talking, Erica says we're talking today about what it's like in Seattle to be a rich, what was the word you used? I'm trying to remember.
Asshole?
The word I used was rich asshole.
Yeah. Rich asshole.
But I will say it was probably in a different context than what you're going to bring up.
No,
but,
that's
but
right.
Go ahead.
It's something that I think people who don't live in Seattle think about. Like, what's it like to live in the land of Amazon and Expedia and Ookla and Microsoft right next door? I guess Boeing is sort of a tech company. And the reason we're talking about this is because Gene Bock, the FYI guy at the Seattle Times, is out with a story saying that the majority of households in Seattle are now earning more than $100,000 a year, and he compares Seattle to the rest of the country where less than a third of households are making that much. At the bottom end in Seattle, 20% of households are earning under $35,000 a year. The first question I have is, his headline is, 100K plus households are now the majority in most Seattle neighborhoods. I'm assuming that exciting headline is designed somehow to, you know, attract Facebook algorithms. But having read that article and with your own perspectives, what would you headline this, Erica Barnett?
I would headline it, who are these people? Because, you know, not only is it the majority of Seattle, you know, now making over $100,000, but 31% make over $150,000, and then they didn't break it down after that. But, you know, I'm sure there are some millionaires in there. And, you know, I mean, it's just such a sign of our divided city that we have, you know, 30% of people living in a city where they, you know, live on $150,000 or more, 20% of people, you know, scraping by on under $35,000. And, you know, and then there's, of course, a rent and homeowner divide within that. But yeah, man, these are not the people I hang out with.
Well, you're hanging out with me.
All right. Touche.
Yeah. I think my headline would be Seattle's progressive piety floats on an infinite sea of new tech money.
That's also not designed to you know, attract Twitter followers, Sandeep. That's
yeah,
the problem.
Yeah, that's what I'm all about is my Twitter following. You know, look, ever since I've lived here, which is I moved here in 2002, so this is my 20th year in Seattle, there's been, I think, it used to be an open fear that Seattle was doomed to become San Francisco. And you know what? I think it's kind of right. We are doomed to become San Francisco, which, you know, is not the greatest thing, which is a sort of hollowed out city where, you know, where we've got lots and lots of well-to-do sort of upper middle class people, and we've got an underclass of poor people and not much in between. And, you know, I think that's the, you know, San Francisco is much farther along on that dynamic than we are. But that's, I think, the cautionary tale for us is that seems to be where we're headed.
Yeah, unless you think that, like, yeah, I mean, the story doesn't break this down, and I'm not able to do a demographic analysis, you know, off the cuff, but like something like 45% of households in Seattle are one person households of people living alone. So, you know, we're not, you know, in all cases talking about combined household income with, you know, two people earning income that's up to 100,000, although there certainly are those. And, you know, and that is, I mean, it's worth considering. I mean, if you have two people making $50,000, you know, that is a $100,000 household. By and large, that's not what we're talking about here. It's that, you know, incredible division of wealth between the haves and have-nots. And I agree with Sandeep. I mean, we have become San Francisco. Our rents aren't quite as bad, but they're getting there.
Why is it happening in Seattle?
Well, yeah, it's tech money, right? I mean, we have. It's interesting because COVID, the last 2 years of COVID has really exacerbated the divides in our economy. And if you're working in the service industry or hospitality, you know, you were probably out of a job for a long time. Maybe you're just going back to work. You know, you were reliant on the federal government funding that came along. But you know what? During the entire time of COVID, the sort of tech economy that has been fueling a boom in cities like San Francisco and Seattle and Austin has continued to you know, boom. I mean, it's been going like gangbusters. Amazon has been growing by leaps and bounds. And so if you're part of that economy, you've been making bank. And so, again, the divides have become even deeper over this kind of weird period we've just lived through.
Yeah, and I want to bring in actually another stat, which was also reported in the Seattle Times, which is that King County lost population for the first time in, you know, in decades. You know, this had columnist Danny Westneat from the Times getting very excited that maybe finally Seattle was going to shrink and we could, you know, we could stop worrying about accommodating this out of control growth. But I mean, looking at the actual numbers, I mean, it was less than a percentage point, and it was during the middle of a pandemic. And I don't see that trend of, you know, Seattle constantly growing because of tech money and tech jobs moving here reversing itself anytime soon. You know, as much as kind of the slow growth crowd wishes it so.
Yeah, I mean, we were the fastest growing city in the country for much of the last decade, right? And that seems to have slowed, and maybe was slowing even before COVID hit. And so I don't know whether we're going to continue to be growing that fast. I mean, remember a few years ago pre-COVID where they were talking about how many cranes there were on the horizon and how much was being built? You know, that seems to have cooled down to you know, some fairly significant extent. And that's probably a good thing because I think we were probably growing too fast. We've talked about this, you know, in other episodes of the podcast that you know, maybe, you know, Amazon's sort of massive expansion was too much, right? And it was, you know, I do think cities need to grow to survive, you know, to be healthy. They need to keep moving and they need to be dynamic, but you know, there are limits and things can get overheated. And I think probably for a while in the last decade, we were a little overheated. So maybe we're coming back down to some more sustainable equilibrium.
So Laurelhurst is the richest, 91% of households making more than $100,000 a year. But the least affluent, nearly 80% are making more than $100,000. It's harder and harder to live here if you're not making that much money,
That's right.
What that says to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at the divide between renters and homeowners, I mean, if you just look at the amount of wealth, you know, I would say the amount of wealth that renters have in Seattle on average is probably higher than in other cities. I think it's over $100,000. But for homeowners, I mean, you know, you're looking at an average wealth of like $1 million. And, you know, that is just, you know, an unfathomable. There's no way to sort of bridge that divide. If you're a renter in the city and, you know, you're throwing your money down the toilet every month, which, you know, half of us do, more than half of us, you know, and spending $2,000 for a smaller and smaller place the longer and longer you live here, I mean, there has got to be a reckoning. And, you know, at some point, and I think we're starting to see this, you know, people who cannot afford to buy a house, people who don't make $100,000 are moving, you know, are moving out, and they're moving out to the suburbs. And I think that's really going to continue, especially if we continue not to build any housing in the city or any significant amount of housing.
I mean, we've built a fair amount of housing over the last 10 years, but just not enough to keep pace with the rapidity of the growth. I mean, look at what happened to Ballard, man. I mean, you know, Erica, I remember when you lived there when it was still a kind of sleepy, forgotten, you know, out of the way Scandinavian fishing village. And I went back when we worked at The Stranger and I was like, why the hell do you live out there? That's crazy, right? Like,
I know, it was crazy. Right. And I moved out of there.
Right. Right. But now, like, every 28-year-old in the frickin' city lives in those huge apartment blocks across Ballard, right?
It's 28-year-olds, is that right?
it feels that way.
David, I know you're too old to do this, but you walked down Ballard Avenue on a Friday night, man. I mean,
yeah, I'm too old to walk, literally too old to even walk now.
There's all kinds of things that result from this type of income gap, which is part of what we're talking about. You look at like places like South Africa, where the income gap is a lot worse, but like, it almost feels like we're headed that direction, especially in affluent blue cities, tech cities like Seattle. And, you know, what can cities do about that? What can the government do about it?
Well, I mean, you know, this might not be the solution, but this is, you know, there's one idea out there, which is the social housing proposal that would provide mixed income housing. So, you know, we're talking about essentially publicly owned public housing. That people without a lot of income could live in and rent, but also that people, you know, of modest means, people, you know, making that 50 to 100,000 range, could rent as well. So that's one idea, you know, subsidizing more mixed income housing. You know, and I think we've got programs that provide a certain amount of housing for middle income people. When new developers build, you know, new buildings, I think that could really be augmented. I don't think that's building nearly enough. So, I mean, there are levers the city can pull, but, you know, I mean, income inequality is not something that, you know, the city itself has a whole lot of power to control. And, you know, people have mobility, people are allowed to move here. You know, we can't build a wall around the city. So, you know, there's only so many levers we can pull.
How successful have places, this is like New Holly and some of these other mixed income developments, how successful have they been up until now?
I think they've been pretty, you know, New Holly and developments like that. I know somebody who lives there. It seems like a lovely, nice community. And those sort of Hope Six projects, you know, mixed income developments, really are the answer, right? They were the fruits of the kind of negative lesson learned from the old kind of Great Society, Cabrini Green sort of efforts where you just build a big concrete tower and fill it up with poor people. And it turned out that didn't turn out too well, right? But doing these kind of more graduated mixed income kind of developments, that's a good thing. We should be doing more of that. I mean, the actual proposal that's been put forward by the Real Change folks about this kind of social housing, it seems kind of weird to me. There's no funding. I don't quite know how it's different from other stuff or what the focus of it is. I just don't quite know whether it's going to mean anything or even if it's going to get on the ballot. But the concept seems good.
Well, I would say too, I mean, you know, apart from sort of building new housing developments and putting people in them and trying to, you know, force, you know, to force mixed income communities, which I agree, you know, sometimes that does work fine. You can't do that with hundreds of thousands of people who are making middle incomes. One thing we could do that, you know, rarely ever gets talked about, and I've never really understood why, is give people shallow rent subsidies, which just means, you know, I make, you know, $70,000 a year. My rent is $2,400. I can afford $2,000. I get $400 a month as a subsidy to help me stay in my home. That's a lot cheaper than, you know, producing a bunch of new housing, which now costs, you know, $300,000-$400,000 a unit. And it's a lot better for the city than everybody just moving to Burien. And, you know, and service workers having to commute in every day. So, you know, that's an idea that would sort of allow people to live all over the city and in some of these exclusive neighborhoods without having to build, you know, a shit ton of new housing.
It's not a crazy idea. The problem is it costs a shit ton of money, right? I mean, when half the city's renters and many, many of those people, I don't know what the percentage is off the top of my head, are, you know, kind of rent burden. To provide that kind of subsidy, you got to give it to everybody, and that adds up really quick to a lots of money, right? And right now we're having enough of a challenge kind of raising enough money to try to make a dent in the, you know, 0 to 30 percent of average medium income, the homelessness problem, right? And now we're talking about, well, what kind of massive subsidies can we provide to the, you know, 80 to 120% of average median, the workforce people. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we don't find a way for people who, you know, who work for a living and who, you know, don't work in the tech industry and don't work in finance and aren't lawyers to live here, then, you know, people like me, I mean, are gonna have to move out because, you know, and go to Tacoma. I know a lot of people that are moving to Tacoma because it's cheaper. And, you know, and I don't think we want that kind of brain drain from our city. So we have to figure out something, you know, that accommodates those workers as well as, you know, the very low income, because I mean, people who are working can also become homeless and then they become much more of a burden on the system.
Right. And I think you and I, Erica, agree about this. We do need to build more, you know, continue to build more housing and more apartments and more workforce housing. I actually think workforce housing, there are things we could do to incentivize significant expansions of private development. I mean, when you're talking about housing for homeless people, it doesn't, you know, that's public money. And I think that should be the priority for public money, because private developers won't build housing for people who don't have jobs, right? But they will for people who have jobs, if you can kind of incentivize that, you know, that stratum. I mean, the fundamental problem, we've talked about this before, is that the people who have moved here over the last 10 years tend to be richer and make more money than the people who are already here. So there's a lot of housing being built, but it's being built at the high end to accommodate those people at the upper end of the income scale. And you're getting, you know, kind of fancy apartments on Capitol Hill or in Belltown or what have you, right? And we need to, I do think we need to incentivize the construction of more workforce housing.
But you know what's kind of cool about that, and I mean, this is the program, I'm trying not to get into too many acronyms, but like there's a program that gives developers, private developers, an incentive to build units for people like me. I mean, yeah. I looked at one before I moved into where I'm living now, and you know, and I qualify for that stuff, and that's, you know, I do think, I mean, I'm not like trying to, you know, build some kind of sob story around people making, you know, 80% of median income or whatever, but we do have those programs. They're just not providing enough housing. And, you know, and I think that's the problem with the design of the program. And, you know, and there was a lot of opposition to providing incentives to developers, and the incentives are generally, you know, tax breaks, because people in the city seem to think that developers are evil, even though we all live in places that were built by developers.
Well, that's right. That was a huge missed opportunity. Under a previous mayor, there was a proposal to really expand that multifamily tax credit so that it wouldn't just cover new construction, but give it to landlords who own existing buildings. If they set aside 20% of the units below market rate, that they would get a tax break. And that would have created thousands of new units of affordable housing, but it got blocked. It got blocked in Olympia by some elected officials because they saw it as sort of too friendly to developers. And this goes to the kind of fundamental argument we've had about sort of development in within the left, I think, in Seattle, is there's the kind of Shama Sawant socket to the developers crowd who are like, anything we can do to screw the private developers is a win for, you know, the socialist left. And then there's
That's like a weird horse to your shoe, but then there's the urbanist crowd around that Alex Peterson.
You're part of, Erica, which is saying build more housing, right? You know, and do things that we need to do to incentivize the construction of not just more housing, but more affordable housing and more workforce housing, which is where I am too. I'm like, dude, let's do that.
Oh God, we're agreeing, David. You have to stop us.
I know.
Gotcha. Sandeep, since you mentioned Shama Sawant and this is Seattle, I should ask, you know, beyond these bourgeois reforms that you're all proposing, we're talking about rising income inequality. What about like up against the wall, motherfucker?
Well, it goes back to where we started, which is again my headline. Like Shama Sawant couldn't exist in this town and wouldn't exist in this town without the infinite sea of new money that her sort of Marxist, you know, ideology floats on, right? I mean, that's the paradox of Seattle, is that we're all of this sort of democratic socialism is intimately connected to and inseparable from the capitalist success stuff.
Well, I don't think that you are familiar enough with Shyamasawant supporters if you think that they're mostly like rich tech bros. I mean, there are certainly some of those.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the problems of success, right? I mean, we are a successful city, a kind of capitalist success story, are the problems that are the levers that are driving an effort to go farther into kind of public and sort of more kind of democratic socialist approaches to try to ameliorate the negatives, right? The inequities.
It's the Marxist dialectic. Speaking of rich people, there's another story that caught our attention this week. Apparently there's a lot more, is this right? There's a lot more dog poop in Seattle is what the Seattle Times is reporting. Eric, I know you've been following this story closely.
Well, I mean, look, first of all, I mean, the Seattle Times story, let's be clear, is based on a press release from a company. But, you know, whatever, fine. It's how many people are complaining about dog shit on Twitter. If we're going to use the same metric across all cities in the U.S., we are at the top or near the top of people complaining about dog shit on Twitter. And, you know, and I do think this ties in with what we were talking about, because Seattle, like for many years, has famously supposedly had more dogs than kids. I think you can kind of measure the wealth inequality of a city by counting how many dogs you see versus how many strollers. And, you know, I did this recently in San Francisco, which, you know, honestly, like, it's the only city I've ever seen that seems to have more dogs and more dog shit than Seattle. So I think that metric, I think that is, that is statistical proof right there. This, by the way, was what I was referring to as rich assholes, is the people who are going around with their dogs and not cleaning up their dog shit. Not the people who are collectively making over $100,000. I don't know them, so I can't call them assholes.
The virtuous working class always cleans up its dog poop. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. You know, I was at the Apple store a couple weeks ago, and there were five dogs in the store. One of them wandering around unleashed, this giant like mastiff dog. And I shamed the hell out of the lady who had the dog, and she did put it on a leash. But I mean, there's talk about a culture of permissiveness, Sandeep. There is a culture of permissiveness towards dogs just running reckless and wild around our city, and it's got to stop.
Yeah, four legs good, two legs bad. That's what I have to say.
All right, we got to leave it there. That's it for this week's edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde. She's Erica C. Barnett. He's Sandeep Kashik. And you can find us on Twitter, where our direct messages are open. It's at Real Seattle Nice at Twitter. You can also donate to Seattle Nice at our Patreon page. Just go to our Patreon page. It's quick. It's simple. We can only do it with your support at Patreon. Thanks so much for everyone who's been donating. And thanks so much for listening.